other thing is that back to the Warners, when the Warners representative came to you and asked you to make the video, are you saying that maybe you guys were the first to make video entertainment? Musical videos?
Well, you know, you can't say first because it's independently, various bands were making their own videos or own films. People were shooting on film then. And it was independently they were doing it. To go on a contract with a record company, yeah, we were maybe the first, Retina Circus was maybe the first group to do that. And to make these promotional programs, they were like two-hour programs we did for Warner Brothers, and they used it to sell their product to all their people all over the world. So when we would do a program, like 12 copies of that program were sent out all over the world to the different Warner Brothers offices to acquaint the staff with the bands. So it was a showcasing of the stable that they had.
Right, it wasn't a con like Don Schuster's. There used to be a Friday night or music video show, music concerts, Don Kirchner or something like that.
Kirchner.
Yeah. And in the '70s, you're saying it was within the industry you would make these commercials.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, for industry circulation.
Yes.
And there'd be more than one band on the 2-hour show.
Oh yeah, 20 bands. Yeah.
Yeah, because they used to make albums like that in late '60s, early '70s. Warner's put out a collection of all the new people they signed. But you're doing the first video, so you were one of the first people hired for the corporate level of video making.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're doing that, and how is your relationship with Cindy going when you're involved with Dino and this, or Desi and this UFO?
There was Dino too. There was Dino also, the fellow, the pilot that got killed, Desi's friend.
Dino Martin? What was it? Martin and
Dino Martin's son. Dino.
Yeah, they'd been singing a little band in the 60s themselves, Desi, Dino, and someone else.
Yeah.
Okay, so but how was your relationship with Cindy during this period? Was she going to L.A. with you? Okay, we got disconnected temporarily there. I was asking you, Robert, what was your relationship with Cindy in this period when you're down in L.A.? Is Cindy hanging out with you?
Yeah, I'm separated off and on here. And when right in the middle of this, I had this hip operation in San Francisco.
And what was that? What was this hip operation? What was that for?
For years I was suffering from a lot of pain in my hip, and due to the degeneration of the socket there, and so finally the doctors arranged said I'm a candidate for this replacement, for a hip replacement. So I went ahead and I had that done in San Francisco. And a good friend of mine is an orthopedic doctor, and he'd been treating me, and he made the arrangements and so forth. And I got it done gratis. I didn't have to pay for it. I didn't have any money at that time. I had a house, but I was a candidate for the surgery. Anyway, after the surgery was over, it's then that my relationship with Cindy came to an end. There was a friend of mine, a guitar player, who was working at our studio, was making a play for Cindy, and I guess she made a play for him. And so they started having an affair, and I got wind to it right away. You know, you can't hide these things. It just, you know, they come out.
Yeah.
And so we broke up. and she shifted and moved out of the house. A lot of emotion, a lot of, you know, what happened, why. I was very, you know, I had a lot of attachment with her, but anyway, it came to an end. And then at that period, then is when I went down to Los Angeles and spent a lot of time down there. And I was away then. Our relationship was over. She and George took off and went. They left San Francisco and went someplace else. And it lasted about a year, and then it ended. And then she later went back to Seattle, and she met an architect, and I guess hit it off, and very nice. She's married now, and
happy ever after. Are you in touch with her?
Occasionally, yeah.
Right. Yeah. But you were a little bitter at that time about what happened.
Yeah, bitter, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, would that be, okay, so that's 74, 75, 75 maybe in there,
75,
right?
75. Mm-hmm.
Well, so go ahead.
So I gave a lot of full time to Los Angeles, being down in Los Angeles then. So,
that was a kind of a lonely, alienated time. You're not making any money, but you're trying to connect in Hollywood. You don't like the Hollywood scene. You don't have a partner. It was probably a downtime in your memory of it.
Yeah, I was, but also it was a good time. I mean, you know, it's it puts you back on your feet, so to speak, you know?
Yeah.
And I felt actually freer, you know, and there wasn't any conflict going on with me in regards to being, you know, having one person and, you know, involved with. You know, whatever you're in a relationship, whoever it is, the relationship is a game we play. One person trying to control the other person, and they use sex, they use this, they use that, they use money, they use all the games to get control of the other person. So when you're free of that relationship, it kind of loosens you up inside. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't involved with anybody, so on any kind of permanent basis, you know, just back to one-night stands.
So right. Now, yeah, was Connie involved with the L.A. productions or the...
Connie was, yeah. But he was really, you know, out of it, you know.
So. Alcoholic.
Yeah, really bad.
So. Did he get into cocaine?
Yep.
That's amazing. We're now talking 20 years, you know, 20 years since you met Connie. People who are listening, look at this. We go from the Portland scene to the Seattle scene to the early San Francisco scene to India, back to San Francisco, Seattle, San Francisco TV. Now you're in L.A. Connie is barely surviving, but he's still having a good time in his terms, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I want to inject a thought here that people might say, how can you be interested in spirituality and movies, you know, Hollywood, you know? All I can say is this. Both are exactly the same. They're both, you know, if you make movies, it's no different than seeking pleasure in finding God, you know, or making lots of money or whatever it is you do. You know, it's an entertainment for us. That's all that it is. Spirituality is nothing more than just entertaining oneself with spiritual ideas that I can be God, or, you know, I can be good, I can be free, I can live without problems, or, you know, I can be, you know, rest, get off the treadmill, you know. It's a hope. It's a pleasure. It's a game. It's a movie. No different.
Right, movies. They say movies are the dream factory, and then there are spiritual dreams.
Yeah, that's all. It's just the imagery is slightly different, but the game is the same. I want to be a movie star. I want to be spiritual. I want to be a guru. I want to be enlightened. I want to be a top star in box office. It's the same thing.
That's right. It's like McLuhan, you know, movies, television, extension of the central nervous system. The spiritual is the inner tripping of the central nervous system, and movies are the external, Western version of the inner tripping, externally.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you mention that data coming in your life made you a little bit conflicted over your spiritual ambitions parallel to your L.A. thing?
Yeah, because he put emphasis on getting back into the you know, meditation and awareness and freedom. You know, he drove home the carrot. He offered the carrot, you know, and he was a very powerful person in his own way. If you're Indian and you wear a white kurta and pajamas, you look like a guru, you know. He had long hair, and he knew the Krishnamurti lingo in and out, thoroughly, intellectually, emotionally, and he was giving his understanding, his grasp of what he had experienced. He had some kind of a mystical experience, no doubt, because there was a certain quietness, stillness, in an energy that you could pick up around him, and he created that energy in you. He could accentuate that energy in you, and it would come up, you know. And light, like attracts like, or something, you know. Anyway.
So he activated that latent Krishnamurti desire in you and made you a little more detached about the L.A. scene as that wore on.
Yeah, right.
But then he left, and it left you adrift again, back at Woodacre.
I asked him to leave. I said, Dada, it's time to move on. You better find another place to live. It's not working out. I felt he was making my house into the ashram. You know, every weekend we had guests from L.A. staying at the house there, and they were sleeping on the floor and taking showers and eating in the kitchen, you know. And I going, wait a minute, whoa, you know, I don't want an ashram here, you know.
Right, so, you're in a very precarious situation. At that point, you don't know that L.A. is the same thing as the Krishnamurti dream, you know.
I don't equate the two.
Yeah, but you think they're inner and outer. They're quite different, thinking.
Yet
you, at the same time, you're in limbo. You can't go too far inner because you don't want to do the guru thing, either be a guru or receive a guru. And so you really had nowhere to go at that point. Now, isn't this when you start doing a restaurant again?
I had to get a job. We closed our studio, and we sold off the equipment and got rid of, everybody got something. I said, I got to get a job. You know, what can I do? You know, I'm 45 years old, you know, or something like that.
No, you're getting near 50, because you're born in 28, and this is 77, 78. You're getting 49, 50.
Well, 46, I got a job.
Okay.
I finally got a job.
Well, that's 74. That doesn't make sense. Yeah. The job happens after L.A.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're saying 76, 77 is when you're with L.A.
Well, I still had this connection going back and forth, you know. But I did get a job working for a mental health program. Maybe I need it. The program was a restaurant for people with mental disabilities, and it gave them a chance to try to work, meet the public. And, you know, just a second. Wait, excuse me. And,
you're talking about the Great Crepe?
Great Crepe, yeah.
Crepe, Great Crepe.
Yeah. Crepe French and crepe is English, yeah.
See,
yeah,
this is in Marin County, right?
Marin County, yeah.
Marin County.
San Rafael.
You've always been dealing with mental health since Portland.
Yeah.
You always were involved with mental health, it seems.
Yeah, something connection. Anyway, I worked there, and they needed a chef, you know. And I was not a chef, but again, I had this enthusiasm and presented myself, and they hired me. And I knew, you know, I instinctively knew how to do it, you know. And the fellow that was leaving the job that was there, I learned real quickly watching him and what he was doing. And so I became the chef. And I turned the restaurant around. It was not making any money. And I turned it around. I made a whole new menu. And suddenly the place got very popular. And we were doing more than crepes. We started doing a lot of other things. Soup, salad, sandwiches, specials, and so forth. And became very popular. And so I worked there for, you know, a couple of years with all these people that were so-called mentally, you know, challenged, shall we say. They all had suffering from schizophrenia or some definition. With, you know, now they have new definitions, you know. But anyway, dealing
Bob
with...
Bob Powers was one of them.
Right. He was a waiter there. And he was so very beautiful, very handsome. And we hit it off right away, you know. And
you mean you became lovers? Did you become lovers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I thought I could help him. That was a mistake. So I thought I could help him understand his how to deal with his mental problem. So he did improve a lot during the time he stayed with me, lived with me. He got another job working at a regular restaurant. But the old demon, you know, they say, it came back with a fury. Partly this was due to his psychiatric relationship to the doctor that he was working with. The doctor took him off his medication as an experiment to see what would happen. And well, it went completely disastrous. He committed suicide.
Right. Now, you know, now on the idea that mental health is chemical, would you agree with the orthomolecular or the vitamin supplement and these other alternative forms of chemical solution rather than just a blatant drug company drugs?
Probably both.
They both work on it.
I knew this. I was suspicious of this way back in the 60s. There was lots of, well, look, that's when they were trying to give they were trying to give, you know, massive doses of drugs to mental patients and noticed that, you know, that they could reduce all the symptoms they were having, all this, the psychoses, you know, and so forth.
Yeah.
So chlorpromazine was a chief drug they were giving, but the drugs all have side effects, also very bad side effects. So it's not an answer either.
You say here in your book on page 173, this step you're talking about the Great Crepe and the data period. This ended the 9-year period of my brush with show business. Let's assume that starts in 67.
Yeah.
68, 9. That's 76, 77. I don't think you were 46 when you got the job, unless you got the job during LA. I think you were 48. You're maybe mixing up with the year 76.
Yeah, right? Anyway, something like that.
Right. Yeah. I'm being a stickler about this because I'm paralleling what I was doing in relation to your circle at the same time, and I'm thinking it's 76, 77, and I was visiting Dave in L.A. a lot, Dave Worster, and I know what he was doing, and it's very interesting that you paralleled him in what he was doing. It was more like he was on the B level, and you were on the A level, but he was involved with restaurants, with Paul Seibel. Westwood. Paul would work there, Dave would hang out, but you have a picture of data, and it's 1976, so I assume that's an American picture, so that gives you a clue on the year, 1976, with data. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say the chapter is called The House of Transition. How long were you at Woodacre? Is this during
about
chemo?
About 4 years. About 4 years. Yeah.
While you were at chemo.
After chemo, I left chemo after Warner Brothers. I bought the house when I was still working with Warner Brothers. And I sold the other house I had in San Selmo and bought this house after Cindy and I broke up. A big change. And Connie and Margot lived with me. And Bob Powers was there.
Mostly, yeah. You were saying.
Yeah, and then there was also a fellow named Paul Zamarian, became good friends, and he was a massage therapist. He was an attorney by profession, but he got tired of being an attorney and liked massage, so he founded the San Francisco School of Massage, and he used to do a lot of massage work at the Woodacre House because he had an extra room he had there, massage room that we made, and I had a hot tub that I put in, and so his clients could have a soak in a hot tub and a massage and hang out under the redwood trees in the beautiful Woodacre, which was really a beautiful place in Marin County.
And he started the San Francisco School of Massage?
Yeah, he and somebody else. So Paul was with me when Bob died and gave me a lot of support at that time. So
I don't know if you indicate in your book that Bob was your lover. You indicate how involved you were with him, but as your lover. Now, where is Marin County? I just flew over San Francisco the other day.
Across the bridge from San Francisco.
No, I mean, I know where Marin County is. I'm wondering, where's Woodacre in Marin County?
To the north.
Okay.
It's San Rafael. Then the next town is San Selmo, Fairfax. Then you go up into the mountains, over the hill, and you're in Woodacre. And that was an Indian spiritual holy place, by the way. American Indians considered it to be a spiritual place. Anyway.
Okay.
Very beautiful.
Right. Now, Connie and Margot is his new girlfriend after the FM DJ, and Margot and Connie have not met the Pong guy. What's that called? The first video thing? Video. Computer?
Yeah.
Pong?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have not met him yet.
Mm-hmm. When Connie and I had a confrontation one night, he was enraged at me about something.
That's a Woodacre. This is a Woodacre.
And he picked up a knife and he threw it at me. Jesus. And it stuck in the wall, you know, in the kitchen wall. And I said, okay, that's it. Finished.
<Yeah.
laughs> On your way, buddy. On your way. So he and Margot moved out. But Donna was trying to break them up. He was doing his best, and she was almost on the edge of moving out. This is what caused Connie to go into a rage. You know? completely out of it. He could be the sweetest, kindest, gentlest, clear person at one level, at another level, completely uncontrollable, out of it, you know. That's insane. Anyway, so Connie, they looked for a job, and they got a job working for someone in Palo Alto, but that didn't work out very long, and they found this job working for the guy who invented Pong. So, and they went to work for him. And he just bought a big home. That was the Folger Coffee Estate in Woodside, California. Here you go again now. So they lived in Woodside at this big palace. And I and Bob used to go down there and spend weekends and lounge around in the hot tub. And there were horses and there was tennis and there was, you know, anything you wanted was there. Connie had a carte blanche.
Is Woodside near Woodacre?
No. It's near Palo Alto.
Oh, okay. I just see a sentence here. Connie and Margot were now fixtures in Nolan's household. That's the name of the guy, Nolan?
Nolan Bushnell. Bushnell.
Right. Okay, so I want to mention an interesting point here. Is that J.J. Hertak, Dr. Hertak, he goes on to become a mystery man in the New Age circuit. And there's a book that came out a few years ago called The Stargate Conspiracy. And it's about the gang around the Nine. Forget his name. Begins with A. Circle around Ira Einhorn. And can't remember Jack Sarfatti and people like in that circle, in which was around San Francisco partly. But Hertak, according to the Stargate Conspiracy, is a cog in the wheel for making contact with UFOs, or at least that's the myth these guys propagate, and it's overlaps with the CIA conspiracy for years to set up the contact with UFOs. It's just that you probably aren't aware that Hertak is a big deal now in certain fringe wacky circles. And he is seen as an agent of intrigue and part of a conspiracy involving the Freemasons that set up Edgar Cayce and a whole bunch of stuff and Egyptology.
Oh, I don't know.
He was
a mixture, Jewish mixed-up kid. A lot of Egyptian mysteries, Jewish Kabbalah mysteries. It was a means for him to establish an identity. Without, if you're going to sell some magic potions, you got to have a definition. You got to describe what it is, not only what it does, but you know what it is itself. And so he created this mythology, borrowed all the mysticism from Kabbalah and Jewish lore and some Egyptology. Egyptian myths and so forth, and mixed it with the UFO, you know, thing. And that was his vehicle. He called them space vehicles, you know. And that was his vehicle for fame, to get what he wanted. He wanted to be a teacher and write books and be a guest and blah, 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 blah. And so anyway...
And be a guest.
I wrote him off completely. It's just another fake, you know. Crazy. I took him one day to meet a musician in Ojai, Roger Killaman, who was a very famous, does scores for movie. Killaway, pardon me. Roger Killaway. And we spent about an hour there. Desi was there, her talk. And after we left, Roger went over to the keyboard of his piano and played that song, Crazy, Crazy, I'm Half Crazy. I said, yeah, Roger, you got it.
So that's after Hertak had left?
Yeah.
Right.
Crazy, crazy,
okay,
I'm Half Crazy.
Oh, here it is. This is the way it is. This is how significant it is. There's this Council of Nine mythology, and a key player with this group was Gene Roddenberry. And the Star Trek series was based on the channelings of the Nine through various people. And and Hertak is part of that circle, supposedly. That's what I was trying to get at. I just Googled it.
I don't know. I met Roddenberry through Desi one day, went to his office, and he said, good luck, you know, with your idea. Just keep... And he was still writing on the Star Trek thing. He wrote all his life on it, you know. So he hit the jackpot on that. But I don't know about her talk. I think there's just a lot of wishful thinking with other people and using each other as a means to get to establish themselves.
Right. Okay. Here, I've got something. Let me just give you something on the net. It says, one New Age channeling cult, above all the rest, has had a huge, very disturbing influence on hundreds of thousands of devotees worldwide. I just want to show you, Bob, how you have effects in this world, in this fringe, a connection. Known as the Nine, its disciples include cutting-edge scientists, multimillionaire industrialists, and leading politicians. This exclusive extract, based on the Stargate Conspiracy book by Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, looks at the sinister origins of the Nine. It's a quote from the mediumship. I am the beginning, I am the end, I am the emissary, but the original time I was on the planet Earth was 34,000 of your years ago. I am the balance, and when I say I mean because I am an emissary for the Nine. It is not I, but it is the group. We are nine principles of the universe, yet together we are one. So that declaration is typical of the channel pronouncements, this article says, about the Council Nine. They contain all the usual New Age ingredients of grandiose statements, shaky grammar, and unprovable predictions. But unlike all the other channeling cults, that of the Nine has serious clout. Perhaps the reason for this is that they claim to be the Ennead, or the nine major gods of ancient Egypt. Or there could be another reason, one that owes more to the X-Files than the pyramid texts. Although the Nine may appear to be quintessentially a modern phenomenon, our research uncovered its truly astonishing pedigree. In fact, the story begins nearly 50 years ago in a private research laboratory in Glen Cove, Maine, called the Round Table Foundation, run by a medical doctor named Andrea Puharich. That's who I was trying to think
of. Oh, I know him. I know Andrea. Yeah. He was a psychedelic researcher, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what period would you have met him?
In the 60s, early 60s.
In the 60s.
Mid-60s, pardon me. It was the LSD brought me to meet him. He was doing research with psilocybin mushrooms.
Right, he actually did research in Mexico the same time as Gordon Wasson did. He was the first guy.
Yeah.
I met him at
Hugh Lynn Casey was at a conference in Carmel. I went to it and met Puharich there, and then later I went to his home in Carmel, another trip I made, and we had some conversations and about his research, and I told him what I was doing with LSD in Seattle, you know.
You mean so, this is in the late 50s or in just before you go to India in 66?
Late 50s.
Late 50s you meet him, right when he was starting. Now that's a pretty good connection, Bob, because he becomes influential in a lot of ways, and you connected with him. He came to the center.
No, I went to his home.
But it's at the time when you were running the center.
Yeah, but he didn't come to Seattle. No, I went to Carmel to attend this conference.
Right.
I don't know what it was. Hugh Lynn Casey was there, and blah blah blah. And I met Puharich there, and then when I knew that he was doing research with the psilocybin, then I told him what I was doing, and then he said, "Yeah, we have to get together." So I arranged I don't know what it was when I was. I remember going to his home. He lived near Carmel, Headlands. Yeah, Headlands. And I went to his home and met his wife, and we spent. Connie and I were there, and we spent hours with him talking. He knew Hubbard and all that. So,
and that was in the late 50s?
Well, it'd be, 58 or 9, something like that.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting connection, because Puharich is involved with HERTAC, but you probably never were told that.
No, I didn't know that.
Interesting interconnection. So, they talk about Puharich. The Round Table Foundation, set up in 1948 to research the paranormal. Among the noted psychics studied at the foundation were the famous Irish medium Eileen Garrett and the Dutch clairvoyant Peter Hurkos. Prominent members included the influential philosopher and inventor Arthur M. Young. Now, Arthur M. Young has been linked in with the Kennedy assassination later, because I think he had something to do with Bell Helicopter. Yeah, he may have started Bell Helicopter. I'll check that in the wiki in a minute. And so you have that interaction. And then there was the socialite Alice Bouverie, née Astor, so from the Astor New York family. In December 52, Puharich brought into his laboratory an Indian mystic named Dr. D.G. Vinod, V-I-N-O-D, maybe it's Vinod.
Vinod.
You heard of him?
No, but that's...
Okay, that's how you say it, Vinod. Who began to channel the Nine, this is in December 52, or the Nine Principles. In the months before Vinod returned to India. A group met regularly to hear the Nine's channel wisdom. Never known for their modesty, the Nine proclaimed themselves to be God, stating, quote, God is nobody else than we together, the Nine Principles of God. 3 years later, there appeared to be independent confirmation of their existence. In Mexico, Buharich and Young, Arthur Young, met Charles and Lillian Lockhead, former Christian missionaries who were by then prominent in the burgeoning UFO contactee movement. For a description of their involvement in the Dorothy Martin circle, see Jerome Clark's When Prophecy Failed. Back in the States a few weeks later, Buharich received a letter from the Lockheads, or Lockheeds, containing messages received by their group's channeler. This message also claimed to come from the Nine Principles, even amazingly including references to the earlier communications transmitted through Dr. Vinod. Vinod, could the Nine possibly be for real? Perhaps the answer is embedded in the career of Buharich himself. After disbanding the Roundtable Foundation in 58, which is about time you met him. You never heard him talk about the Roundtable Foundation.
I know he was interested in his psychical research and paranormal, things like that.
Okay.
And I wasn't particularly interested. I had gone through my experience with it, and I was, you know, at that time I was not interested in it particularly.
Okay, so what happens is that, so he disbands that in 58. He worked for 10 years as an inventor of medical devices and achieved international recognition as a parapsychologist, most famously studying the Brazilian psychic surgeon Arrigo. But all that was to pale into insignificance because in 1971, Buharich discovered Uri Geller. Think of that whole Geller thing. Did you know that Buharich did that?
No, I didn't know that, no.
At their first meetings in Tel Aviv in 71, Buharich hypnotized Geller in an attempt to find out where his abilities came from, just like Stan Collins hypnotized Ralph Doobie.
Yeah.
As a result, the young Israeli started to channel Spectra, an entity which claimed to be a conscious supercomputer aboard a spaceship. However,
whoa!
And this overlaps. This overlaps with Robert Anton Wilson, who writes a book about the computer in the Illuminatus Trilogy. Have you ever heard of those books, the Illuminatus Trilogy?
Yeah. So, Bob, let me inject something here. I'm getting a reaction here.
Yeah.
Sound like David Wooster now. Anyway. All the thoughts, all the experiences that humankind has experienced are alive, vibrating, living in a sphere of thought. So what you're talking about, all this is valid in terms that it has this existence in this level of refined consciousness or whatever it is that's keeping this thing alive. So in that you'll find everything is there. You know, so things will crop up and correlate back and forth. It's all there. It's all a tremendous reservoir of information, ideas, thoughts, feelings, experiences. Everything is there. So it's all real in that context.
It's like a big supercomputer.
Yep, with a big hard drive.
Well, look. We were talking about the difference between movies and the spiritual life, and then how they aren't the same, aren't different. Well, we're getting here in 71 the merging of the inner and the outer with this idea that this conscious supercomputer is doing the channeling, or is what's being channeled. There's the merger of the inner and the outer technology.
So this information that so-called channelers are channeling is coming from this source, this, you know, but according to each channeler's own special background, it gets colored by that. It gets translated. Okay?
Yeah.
I was talking to Hewlin Casey about this, about in regard to his father, and he said, because my father was brought up as a Christian in a simple, you know, Christian system of thinking, this information all is colored by that, you know? And if Edgar Casey had been an Indian, a Hindu, it would have been colored by the Indian traditional ideas, or Buddhist, or Muslim, or Jewish, or whatever. So all the, you know, everything gets, it even in Yuji says, I give expression to what's, to this energy. And that expression is Yuji. It's all colored by my, by his background, you know. It comes through that. I'm kind of not quoting him, but this is what I glimmered from him, you know. So each and every person is an individual expression of this vast, you know, sea of consciousness, you know, which has everything in it. Yeah, everything has everything in it. Everything.
And it's here.
What do you think of? It's here now. It's there. Yeah. And it's, and it's the burden.
The burden, the capital B burden.
Yeah, it's the burden. See, we're,
it's the, we're, it's the tree of knowledge.
Yep. Yeah, and with it comes pain, suffering, separation.
Yeah, the Apple computer.
the super. Yeah.
Okay, let me just finish this.
Kubrick's movie 2001 was intrigues me still today about how the computer was running everything.
Right. Let me just finish this, because the point is, it synchronously ties in with your experience, your the people you connected. Okay, it says so. You know, Geller's channeling this conscious supercomputer aboard a spaceship. However, Puharich suggested to Geller that there might be a connection with the nine principles, and Spectra readily agreed that there was. The nine claimed that they had programmed Geller with his powers as a young child. Through Geller, the nine alerted Puharich to his life's mission, which was to use Geller's talents to alert the world to an imminent mass landing of spaceships that would bring representatives of the nine. You see, this is what happened to Puharich, the guy that you see 15 years before.
Too many mushrooms.
Yeah. And did you, you talk about talking with Hewlin Casey, that's in the late 50s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, your only one-time conversation with him.
No, two. I've had two.
When was the later one?
Seattle. Earlier in Seattle. we talked about it.
Yes, that's right. And then the second one is around the time of Puharich.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. However, Geller... Go ahead.
Well, Hewlin Casey is making a living out of Edgar Casey, you know?
It's his work. However... Did you say that was his work?
Is he dead? What?
No, I don't know. You said that's his work?
That was his work, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. However, Geller, by now an international psychic superstar, bowed out in 73 and has resolutely turned his back on the nine ever since. Puharich had to find other channels. He joined up with aristocratic former racing driver Sir John Whitmore and Florida-based psychic healer Phyllis Schlemmer. They found a new channeler, a Daytona cook known to history only by the pseudonym Bobby Horn, who lived to regret. This channeler lived to regret his dealings with the Nine. Driven to the brink of suicide by their constant demands, he too dropped out of the scene, his despair being dismissed by Whitmore as signs of instability. After this, Phyllis Schlemmer was appointed the authorized spokesperson for the entity, known simply as Tom, who represented the Nine. Now, Puharich, Whitmore, and Schlemmer then set up Lab 9 at Puharich's estate in Ossining, New York. The Nine's disciples included multimillionaire businessmen, many hiding behind pseudonyms and including members of Canada's richest family, the Bronfmans, European nobility, scientists from the Stanford Research Institute, and at least one prominent political figure who was a personal friend of President Gerald Ford. We also know that Lyle Watson, then the darling of the alternative scene because of his seminal 1973 book, Supernature, that he was involved, as was the influential counterculture guru Ira Einhorn, who's now in jail for murdering his girlfriend in the late 70s. He finally got nailed in a few years ago. And also Gene Roddenberry. Some people, a little later it says, Roddenberry was part of that circle in 74 and 75, and he even produced a screenplay for a movie about the Nine. Maybe that, isn't that, that's the same period you guys are doing. Now look at this. This could be an overlap. they are doing a screenplay about this UFO stuff right when you guys are doing it, and the common denominator is HERTAC.
Mm.
HERTAC might have been talking their stuff to you, and he didn't tell you.
Possibly. By the way, I met Uri Geller. We did a video shoot of one of his demonstrations in San Francisco in 1975, before I had the hip operation. And our company, Retina Circus, did the production. It was done at the Masonic Temple in San Francisco. And after the demonstration, I was back on stage, and Geller was looking at the playback on the monitor, and I walked up to him and said, "Hello, I'm blah blah." You know, a funny thing, he turned to me, and in a very serious voice, he said, "Don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. You're going to do fine." Said, what? Yeah. I was going into surgery the next day. I was going to go to the hospital the next evening and to have the hip surgery.
And he seemed to know that.
Something.
Well, did he do a successful spoon bending?
He did the spoon bending and the key bending and the watch starting and the, I don't know. We got it on tape. You know, I could see it bending.
Okay, well, look, in that very period, Roddenberry was part of the circle and even produced a screenplay for a movie about the Nine. How much he was influenced by them is unknown, although it is said that some of their concepts found their way into the early Star Trek movies and the series called The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine, there you have it. There is a character named Vinod, in one Deep Space Nine episode. Another key player in Lab 9 was Dr. James J. HERTAC, who was appointed Perharich's second-in-command by the 9. In fact, HERTAC had been independently channeling the 9 since 1973. So he was channeling the 9 before he met you. Perharich and the British guy, Sir John Whitmore, commissioned British writer Stuart Holroyd to write an account of their adventures, which appeared in 77 as Prelude to the Landing on Planet Earth, retitled Briefings for the Landing on Planet Earth in paperback. In this extraordinary book, the true identity of the Nine and of Tom was finally revealed. Are you okay with the sound there?
Yeah, by the way, look up Beardsley Graham.
Yeah, I tried him. I didn't get anything, but I'll try again.
Yeah.
We're getting... Here, push your jack in.
Yeah.
Yeah, just in case that's causing the noise. Okay, we're okay. You ready? We're continuing. Okay, in this extraordinary book, the true identity of the Nine and of Tom was finally revealed. Far from being the chummy character that his rather avuncular name suggests, Tom is actually Atum, A-T-U-M, the creator god of the ancient Egyptian religion of Heliopolis. This is like, sound like Rai. And Uncle Tom with his eight mates are none other than the great Ennead or Aeneid of Heliopolis. But even with such impressive contacts, all was not well with Perharich. Lab 9 broke up in 78 after a series of mysterious events that culminated in an arson attack on the Osinni estate, and Perharich fled to Mexico, claiming that he was being persecuted by the CIA. He returned to the USA 2 years later and appears to have played no further part in the 9 story. He died in 1995 after falling down the stairs in his South Carolina home. However, the 9 continued. Not only did Schlemmer and Whitmore continue their mission, but Dr. HERTAC has also moved on. He's become a major player in the unfolding millennial drama currently being played out at Giza. But perhaps more importantly, he has established himself as a New Age guru par excellence, traveling the world giving workshops on his book of channel revelations from the Nine called The Keys of Enoch.
Yeah.
Written and laid out in classic biblical style, its darkly apocalyptic vision has huge numbers of influential devotees. This we find very worrying. I will stop there, Bob. But just incredible that you overlap with these people at such an early period.
No, crazy.
That's yeah, you didn't crazy. Know this part. You didn't know this part.
No.
Okay, now we got into all this right when you were talking about the restaurant and the mental therapy restaurant.
Yes. It overlapped.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
And so it gets to the point where where Bob Powers dies, and then you have your next channel, which is called The Turning Point. And right. that's when you meet Eugene.
We'll leave that for the next session, then, okay?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. It's all this information, connectedness. Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's all, it's strange. You know, all I can say is that we use whatever we can as a means to further our self-importance, to keep going.
Yeah. You know, I got a sneaking suspicion that I read about you on the internet about 4 years ago, and you discussed the death of Connie, and I told Worcester, hey, I found Bob Carr. And I'm pretty sure right around that time is when I met Hertak. See, there's the hidden meme synchronicity. Yeah.
Mahesh Bhatt wrote about the... Mahesh Bhatt wrote in his... he wrote a piece called Taste of Death. And in there's a part about when I'm in Switzerland and I get a phone call from the embassy in Thailand that Connie's died.
And, right. You do that in the book.
Yeah, 95, was it?
Yeah, 95. Now, what are you saying about Mahesh? What did he do?
He wrote a piece on this, and that might have been on the internet.
That's not what you sent me recently.
No, this is something else, yeah.
So that's Beardsley Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M?
Yeah, Beardsley Graham. He worked with the space agency in Palo Alto there, NASA.
Maybe that's what I got here. I just found, just a second. This is the White House. Below is the text of a letter from the president to the incorporates of the Communications Satellite Corporation.
And he helped design the first satellite that went up. Comsat satellite?
Yeah, they're talking in October 18, 62. This is early. And they list Beardsley Graham of Kentucky.
Yeah. Interesting character. Really interesting character. Smooth operator.
What? How did he come in your book? I forget what you mentioned in there.
He Hertek knew him and introduced me to him. And he was a different caliber altogether. And he wasn't buying Hertak's ideas at all.
But Hertak knew him. I mean, Beardsley Graham must have been an older man.
Yeah, older, yeah.
And yet Hertak knew Beardsley.
Yeah. Oh, Hertak was all connected, you know, all the spaceships and everything.
Well, that's satellite stuff, right. So was Hertak teaching outside San Francisco or L.A.?
Yeah, both. He had a job teaching at a college, some community college in Los Angeles, and that's where Desi met him. He was a teacher there. He had some kind of credentials, but I don't think he had a doctorate degree, really. Maybe he did. I don't know.
Yeah, when I met him, he talked about, I think he started out of Chicago or someplace, but he said that he read McLuhan and used McLuhan in his... in his early, you know, pre-experience of 73, because it says he's a social scientist, so that's like sociology. And that's how he began, I think. Anyways, a lot of, you know, Russell Targ and those Stanford research people that became the secret funding of the CIA of remote viewing research. All that starts with Uri Geller in 73, and Jack Sefardi meets these people, and there's an intertwining with Hal Puthoff and a lot of people who are prominent in the New Age circuit who are legitimate. And a lot of them are Scientologists, and they gathered at the Stanford Research Center, or whatever it was called, and they did remote viewing. And
What happened to Uri Geller? Where is he now?
He's doing very well in England, I think. He has a big estate. Recently, Jack Sarfati said...
Did he get into the holy business? Is he in the holy business, kind of?
So I think it's something. I think it's like Save the World. Let me just check it out here on the wiki, because Jack Sarfatti sent me pictures about a year ago. He visited Uri in England, and he had some kind of institute. If I go down to the bottom here, let's see what he's doing now. In November 2000, Geller sued video game company Nintendo over the Pokemon character Jungerer, localized in English as Kadabra, which he claimed was an unauthorized appropriation of his identity. The Pokemon in question has psychic abilities and carries bent spoons. Geller also claimed that the star in Kadabra's forehead and the lightning patterns on its abdomen are symbolisms popular with the Waffen-SS of Nazi Germany, and he was outraged at the connotations that Nintendo had supposedly made. Although the symbols are derived from Zener cards, the name is a pun. The katana describes the kana. The transliteration of Mr. Geller's name into kataka would be, and it gives a bunch of symbols. Geller sued for £60 million, but lost. He also considered a suit against IKEA over a furniture line featuring bent legs that was called the Uri line. Okay, here's it. In March 2007, videos clearly showing Geller cheating were removed from YouTube due to copyright claims by Explorologist Limited. Explorologist Limited is operated by Geller, who owns 75% of the company, and his longtime manager brother-in-law, Shimshin Strang, who owns 25%. James Randi noted that Geller did not own the copyright to the clips, which includes Geller's appearance on The Tonight Show. On May 8, 2007, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's the Wired magazine people before at the beginning, sued Geller on behalf of Brian Sepian for making false claims to force YouTube to remove a video. YouTube eventually reversed their decision to remove the video. The EFF posted the documents pertaining to Sapient versus Geller online. The removals have caused a backlash against Geller. In a press release by Explorologist Limited, Geller's business, it was announced that on February 3, 2008, Judge Von Walker dismissed the EFFS, Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit, on the basis that the court did not have jurisdiction over Geller, a British subject, or Explorologist Limited, an English company. Judge Walker suggested that the case could be handled in Philadelphia, where Geller filed suit against the same skeptic, claiming that the YouTube post violated British copyright law.
Blah, 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 yeah.
So he's got a lot of headaches happening right now.
Yeah, Bob.
for Uri.
Yeah.
But not for you,
so
Bob.
When do we go on again, then?
In 24 hours.
All right.
Actually, 22 hours.
Okay, tomorrow.
Tomorrow 11 your time, 7:30 my time.
Yeah, we'll try. Hopefully we get a good connection early, okay?
Well, we did tonight, so very good, Bob. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye, Scott.
Good night, Robert.
Good night.
Good night.